Well, hello and welcome to the Ridge YA podcast, a podcast for young adults all about what it looks like to follow Jesus as a young adult in our age and culture. I'm Dan. I'm the pastor of youth and young adults at Ridge Church, and I want to welcome you. This is episode one. We are just jumping into this brand new podcast. We're so excited. We've got a number of great interviews coming up over the next several weeks and months with some amazing leaders from across Canada who have so much to say about what it looks like for us as a community and as young people to actually follow Jesus in an age and a culture where that may not be the norm. And so we're going to hop right in today. Our first episode is with Michael Chinchilla. He is the lead pastor at Village Calgary, and he was the youth pastor for a long time at their Surrey location. And we're so excited to talk to him about he and his wife moving to Alberta in the midst of a pandemic, what that's looked like to navigate the change, how to have a resilient faith, and what it looks like to follow Jesus when the world might seem to say that it's not worth following Jesus. And so we're excited to hop into this interview. He had so much great stuff to say, and we can't wait for you to hear it. So without much more, let's hop right in. Well, hey, Michael, thanks so much for being with us. I'm so excited you are joining us all the way from Alberta. And tell us, what is it like in the province to the east of us right now?
It's tough. Yeah, there's, I feel like maybe it's just me, but Calgary has an interesting kind of dynamic between Calgary and Vancouver. So all this pandemic stuff's been going on. They're like, well, how bad is BC doing? That's kind of like the main language. And then we eventually find ourselves to be like, wow, we're way worse. So, yeah, it's been weird. It's been very strange. I think our regulations and limits are harsher. So, like, we're not even allowed to do any outdoor gatherings at all. We can't do any gathering of any sort. Can't have anybody in your home. Can't go to restaurants. No coffee shops. Everything is closed down. So it's pretty zombie land around here. So yeah, it's been a weird season, especially as a pastor of a church. So it's not the easiest.
Yeah. And you were telling me a little bit about you and your wife moved there just before COVID-19 kind of hit and everything went crazy. Can you tell us a little bit about what that looked like for you guys?
Yeah, I made the joke earlier, and I'll make it again, that I think we should probably write a book on this experience of like the best way to lead a church, which is move to a province that you've never lived in before, have one live service, and then have a global pandemic happen and then don't meet anyone. I think that's probably the best way to do it. So, yeah, it's been obviously weird because it's like you're meeting people for the first time over Zoom. And I don't know, it's kind of weird to like, maybe it's not, I don't know, but like to ask another random stranger of a guy and be like, hey, do you want to go on a walk and like just meet each other? Like, that's just, I don't know. So it's, yeah, it's been a weird season to try to get to meet people. So we've tried to do online, like we've done like three trivia nights. We've done a bunch of prayer nights. We did women's conference, like a bunch of stuff online here that's helped, but obviously it doesn't substitute for the real thing. So it kind of feels, like all the administrative infrastructure stuff of the church, the systems, we've really like got to redo a little bit, and that's been great. But all the people stuff has really been lacking. So that's yeah, that's been a bit of a problem.
And did you guys know a lot of people? Do you have family out there, friends out there, people you knew as you headed out to Calgary?
No, like we don't know anyone. So we kind of showed up and, yeah, we were like, oh, you know, the church is going to be our community or whatnot. And that really, it's happened to an extent and people have been really, really kind. I think that's been one of the beneficial parts about this. But yeah, we don't know anyone. So yeah, the other day, my wife and I were on a walk and we were just like, hey, you know what? Like the pace of life that we were living in BC was so fast, so quick. We were moving to event, we were doing thing to thing. And I had said to her one time, I'm like, man, like, I wonder what our marriage is going to be like when we slow down. Like, are we still going to like find joy and have a really good conversation? And like, and I'm kind of one of those people who I'm like a risk assessment person. I find like every obstacle like well ahead of time. So we were having this conversation and then we show up to Alberta and it's exactly that. Like, you're not running from the thing to thing. It's like, you're playing your seventh game of crib. You're like watching Pirates of the Caribbean, like the fourth time over or whatever.
Right.
And, and it's been really, really joyful. Like, we've had a really great time in terms of just us together. And so when we were on a walk the other day, I said to her, you know what, if this whole like us moving to Alberta thing was just for our marriage, it was well worth it. Not because there was anything wrong or whatever. I think it was just an affirmation of like, we really enjoy spending time with each other. And it's been cool.
That's very cool. I think one of the things that's been like interesting, even as we chatted before this, around like how that change looks and the navigation of that, I feel like for a lot of young adults, myself included, my wife and I moved here 6 months before. So anytime I feel sad about like, oh, we didn't have much time to get to know people, I just think of you. And I feel like, oh, we had like a million years to get to know people before things shut down.
I'm glad we could be that beacon of hope.
but I think that idea of like immediate hard change, it is really a challenge. And especially right now, it feels almost exhausting and tiring. And like the littlest things seem to be kind of making people feel more tired than they would have maybe a year ago. And so for you guys, as you navigate it, right, like you're moving provinces, you're going to not a new church, but a new campus, a new community. You're trying to get to know people. You're trying to figure all these things out. It's new house. Like if anyone's been married and moved, like that's not a fun, simple, clean experience.
Right.
All those kind of things. How does change impact you in the midst of all this kind of stuff?
Yeah, my wife and I are pretty averse to change. Like, we don't really have a whole lot of obstacles. If anything, I would probably be less flexible than her. Like when we had the whole Calgary, Alberta thing happen. Yeah, she was pumped and I was a little bit more hesitant and trying to figure out like what could go wrong here, so on and so forth. I don't know. I feel like I've had a weird journey with the Lord where I feel like change, like dramatic change, has been a marker of like moving into a new season. So as an example, I feel like 21 to 23 was like a really rough age for me. Like tough, like I had to go see psychologists and counselors and like pastoral care. And there was like all these, all this stuff that was going on because of certain circumstances and situations. And then as I was, you know, turning 23, whatever, May, I graduated my undergrad. I started my master's. I got married. I bought a home and got a promotion all in the same week. And so it's kind of always felt like when God is telling me that a different season is coming, it comes with a ton of different change. And so that's kind of been the sense in our journey with the Lord that's been more of a welcoming factor rather than a fear of like a ton of changes happening. This is pretty exciting because it means that maybe we're moving into something different.
Right.
And so it's been pretty great for us. So and the difficulty of things moving and change and, you know, obstacles or things that you have to get through, that's kind of the Christian life, right? So you hear Paul talking about, you know, you got to be like the athlete, you got to be like the farmer, you got to have to, you know, have this idea of endurance, because endurance builds character. And so ultimately, when you're looking at your life, especially as somebody who's in ministry, a Christian, you know, follower of Jesus in general, character is something that we don't necessarily think about too much, but it's something that we definitely need to be able to grasp. And you can only gain character via change.
Why don't you think we think about character very much? Because I would totally agree. But why is that? Where's that gap that happens there?
Yeah, I think we think of it in terms of like holistically, like who am I as a human being? So we go like, I want to be a better person.
Sure.
So, but we leave it in such general language that we don't get to specifics, that nothing actually changes. And so sometimes it's, you know, I don't want to get angry at my kids, or I don't want to get angry with my, you know, girlfriend, or I don't want to use my money in a certain kind of way, or I want to be more generous, or I want to say. And so once you get into those specifics, then that's a lot of work, right? Yeah. It's biting your tongue. It's praying for someone that you don't even necessarily really like. It's you get into these really difficult situations where the character building goes into, but a lot of those efforts we don't want to voluntarily step into because they're hard. And most of us, that's obviously a big generalization, I think are averse to pain enough that we just want to avoid as much as possible. But if you keep avoiding, then character doesn't grow. And yeah, it's one of those weird things that, you know, you kind of hear around church or whatever, but character is one of those things that is fluid, like it moves. Mm-hmm. So one person said, you know, it takes years to grow character and only takes moments to lose it.
Yeah.
And so it's a weird difficulty because it's something that has to be sustained. There's longevity to it. It's gradual, right. Not immediate. I can't just get, I'm a man of character now, you know, you can't just do that. And so small gradual changes over time is really averse to our culture, which is immediate, big, quick. Let's find the next, you know, big giant tech thing that hasn't happened yet. And let's move into the next, you know, paradigm of the world or whatnot.
Right.
Let's send rockets to space. Let's get holograms. Let's get like, everyone's looking for the new big thing. And the small gradual thing has been left kind of behind, but that's eventually what we find to be the most important.
Yeah. No, that's really good. I think like that change being the place where like pain happens and suffering happens and those kind of things, and it forms character, is, like you said, really not comfortable. One of the things that I've noticed kind of in that same vein over the last number of months is I've interacted with different generations. So like I talked to my parents, or I talked to seniors in our church, and then I talked to people our age, my age, youth and young adults who I primarily work with. Every generation is kind of dealing with this pandemic a little bit differently. And so where my parents are more looking and they're concerned about like, you know, I don't want to get this thing because if I get this thing, I don't know about my health based on whatever situation. But a lot of the young adults I talk to, like that's not the primary fear. The primary thing that's happening right now is like depression and anxiety and stress and almost like retreating of, I don't know what to do and I don't know how to do it in this season. Where do you think that tension comes from? And why do you think that, I want to be careful with how I say it, not that the pandemic is hitting the young adult generation, whether that's Gen Z or late millennials, really hard or more hard than anyone else, but in such a specific way in terms of mental health and engagement that way, why do you think it's hitting our generation? Because you've worked with youth, you've worked with young people. Why do you think it's hitting us in this way?
Yeah. So I've heard it said, I don't even remember who said it, that every generation is built off of the crisis of their youth. So as an example, so my generation would have been like 9/11 would have been a big thing that would have happened for us, and just kind of seeing the world turning on itself and, you know, enemies. And then that obviously results in a bunch of different changes. And so imagine going to an airport pre and then post 9/11, like that was like a firsthand experience that I felt that change. The introduction of, you know, the iPhone, social media, things of that nature, really have an impact. And so what begins to happen is I kind of make the joke that 2020 made socially distanced cool, but 2007 is really the thing that started it. And 2007, the beginning of the iPhone, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those things that begin from that age, created social distance because we became a culture that had a lot of friends, but didn't have any friends. And so what I mean by that is you have a bunch of people who know about your life, but when something really happens to you, who do you actually turn to and run to? That's a very small list. Yeah. If there's a list at all, if you have a longtime friend, like you are a blessed individual. Yeah. So the difference between how different generations have taken this pandemic, I feel like has happened because of firsthand experience based off of a crisis. Mm-hmm. So if you look at older generations as they're going through things like, you know, the Cold War or things from post World Wars or whatever, you know, things in the US, like Vietnam War or something like that, things that have happened a bit later, there was firsthand experience of difficulty that they had to run through. Whereas the difficulties of our, like, crisis of our age when we were kids were very much distanced from us. We felt the repercussions, but it wasn't necessarily that direct. So for me, 9/11 wasn't like a direct hitting home. I didn't have family or friends or people that were directly involved with those things. Yeah. But what it made me think was the way that immediately everybody turns on each other. Mm-hmm. And so now what I want to do is I want to fight against the everybody turning on each other. So two things happen. One is people militarize, and the other, people become very, very, and then here's the key word, very tolerant. Mm. So as soon as that happens, all of a sudden you heard this like very anti-Muslim sentiment. Right. And so for some people, it's like, well, now we need to love those kinds of individual because they're being ostracized by the community. Mm. Others, will become very militant. And then those anti, you know, whatever fears just become to be stronger. Right. So you have all these multiple reactions. And so the whole, everybody love each other, everybody care for each other, everybody has happened because not only is there a sense of, you know, we don't want to go against a certain generation because we've known the rhythms of that before. Think of things like slavery. You know, even recently, there's just been the Latin American caravans to the U.S. Like, we're always thinking about the other. And so how do we welcome the other has been one of the perceptions.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been a weird season for us as millennials or Gen Zs to go, this is now a crisis that personally affects me. And I have no history of something like this before. Whereas older individuals have gone, I watched my father go through, my family didn't have to. And things are just really easy for us.
Yeah.
Things have happened so quickly, movement, and we don't necessarily find ourselves in position where what we want, we can't get. And that's what the restrictions have been. It's sorry, you can't actually go and do that. No. Right. But I've always learned how to, or I've always gotten to, or I've always wanted to watch, or I've always wanted to stream, or I've always wanted to buy and get it at my house in 15 minutes or whatever. And that's just not something that we like. So it's obviously going to be a bit difficult for us.
Yeah. And then the other nature, and again, I don't know exactly the dynamics in Alberta, is that now we're in a second lockdown. And what I'm almost sensing and feeling like, even in my own soul, is like first lockdown, it was a little bit like, okay, this is going to be hard, but we'll do it. And then summer, things ease off and it starts like a feeling of like going back to normal. And so a few weeks ago when in BC, we pivoted back to kind of a lockdown state, and it was, okay, you went from your like safe six and you could do gatherings of 50 and all these kind of things to actually know we're moving backwards now because that's what needs to be done because cases are skyrocketing, all those things. It almost hit harder in a sense of, I thought we had made it through. I thought we had done our due diligence. I thought we had suffered enough. And what I'm seeing and sensing is sort of an angst that's happening now of, well, at what point do I get to just do what I want? And so can you maybe speak to that and how that maybe plays into our faith and how do we understand that as us, when we're getting to the point where I'm hearing more and more of just, I don't care what the rules are. I just want to go see people. I just want to do this, whatever. Christmas, we're recording this just before Christmas. And so it's right now, a lot of conversations I'm having is with people around, what are you going to do for Christmas? Are you going to follow the rules? Or are you not going to follow the rules? Or what are you going to do? Or all those kind of things.
Yeah.
And how do you think that plays into, because I think it's really easy to kind of like, make this dualism between like what's happening here versus like, here's how I follow Jesus. But how does how we follow Jesus play into everything that's going on with a second lockdown, even though we're exhausted?
Yeah. I heard it said once that Christmas is kind of like a magnifying glass of your year. So whatever your year has been like, Christmas just magnifies that thing and makes it bigger. So if 2020 was like super good for you, or let's just say 2019, 2019 was an amazing year, and you get to Christmas time, it's just a magnifier of that. There's much more joy, many more carols. It's much more merry, you know. But if 2019 was really difficult for you, then I think Christmas time kind of accentuates that sadness a little bit. So now imagine our whole country, our whole world is now in the state of, you know, this isn't anywhere what we wanted our year to look like. And, you know, it's been crazy and working at home and the whole thing. And then it gets to Christmas time. So now Christmas just kind of makes it all a lot worse. So as an example, I don't get to see my family back in BC. We had bought plane tickets. We were going to go. And then, Dr. Bonnie Henry changed the restriction times. And then it's like, well, we can't go anymore. Like, that's a thing. And there's a bit of a different example, I think, for myself, not necessarily saying whatever, because, you know, I'm the leader of a faith community, you know, so I'm a leader of a church. There's people looking at my example. And so my actions actually have a ton of different repercussions rather than maybe somebody else. And so I also have to keep some of those things into account. But I think that's really what has made the second lockdown perception that much harder. So things in Alberta that we've heard is, why didn't they do stricter restrictions in the summertime or leading up to this now? So eventually the goal could have been, you could be with your family in Christmas.
Right.
Why is it that they had these lax restrictions? Why did we go back to normal kind of a bit And then right when everybody wanted to be with family, then they made them really hard. And obviously you can go and speculate and you can do the whole things. You know, the governments are trying to hold not only just public health and the economy in balance the whole way through. There's a ton of different variables and factors that we're not privy to or whatever. But I think that's what's changed our perception about the second one. And it really has been like, we went through the first one. We don't see any change really. In fact, it's gotten worse. Mm-hmm. So now we're in the second one. What's saying that this is going to make any difference? Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of, there's the, now we have a kind of a view of suspicion towards some of these measures. Mm-hmm. And I think that's made it a little bit more difficult. There's always the piece as a follower of Jesus where for me, you know, I get the passage in Romans where you have to honor the authorities that are above you. Why? Because God is essentially the one who has placed them in those positions. And so, there are going to be difficult times where, you know, when you have to push back against those authorities. So think of, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. said that the only way that we know human law is correct is because there's a divine law above it. And so you contrast the human law with the divine law. And if it doesn't match up, you push against. I don't see this as that. Other people might have different perceptions, but I look at the way that God has asked us to honor certain people, and the 20 to 40 demographic probably doesn't care as much because in general, they're probably going to be okay if they get COVID. Not thinking of the implications of what happens to the rest of the people around you if you take it and then you act flippantly. And I think if I look at Jesus, who constantly has the other in view, growing up in church, I was probably 15. This guy introduced me to this idea called others interested, that your whole life as a Christian should be others interested. And it really impacted me as like a high school student. And it's like, man, what if I thought through every single one of my actions, not through the lens of how it benefits me, but the effect of what it has on other people. And so if I think of this COVID situation in that exact same framework, then it makes it really easy for me to be like, I can handle sitting at home for however long that I need to, so that my actions don't negatively impact families who may have someone who's immunocompromised or somebody who's in the elderly community or something of that kind of age bracket. I'm okay with that. So as a follower of Jesus, I think those things line up to just be like, let's just chill. It's going to be a sad season, but who knows? Maybe that makes 2021 Christmas that much better. You know, so.
No, that's good. In that sitting, in that waiting, which I think so many of us are in right now, how do you do community? Like, is community even possible to do over Zoom? Like, because I can have a Zoom conversation, but I can't, you know, hug someone or let them know I'm there for them or put my hand on their back and pray for them. Or, you know, I can be praying for someone over Zoom and then the internet sucks, so it stops working. Like, any of these reasons, it can feel a little bit like right now is, okay, I want to honor the government. I want to do these things. I want to wait. I want to protect people. I want to, you know, honor and love my neighbor by keeping them safe. But it feels like community is kind of impossible in the midst of that. Like, it means I can't connect. I can't be close to people. I can't experience other people loving and caring about me, whatever that looks like. Is community even possible right now?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I would push back on what community even looked like before the pandemic for most people. Yeah. Because community for them probably just meant a FaceTime here and there, texting back and forth, maybe an occasional coffee or a dinner, but it wasn't like I'm hanging out with these people every single day. It was maybe I had a face-to-face interaction with them at church on a Sunday, or maybe at a community group or a small group or whatever anybody wants to call them on a weekly basis. And so for us, I'll give you the reverse. So basically what you're having is you have a community that you hang out with all the time. Now you've lost that and you've had to go to Zoom. Can you still have community? Well, we're the opposite. We come to Calgary and we have no community. There's absolutely nothing. So we're not losing anything. So as we're kind of here for a couple of months, my wife and I have this conversation and say, we should probably start a community group because maybe that'll be something that we can have as a part. Right. And so now, instead of having the perception of losing something, we've gained an online on Zoom community group. And it's been a game changer for us. Mm-hmm. So the way that we have conversations, or the way that we text with people, or we started like a group chat on WhatsApp, which is like either going to be the bane of your existence or the most fun thing on the planet, right? And it's been a blast. And so for us, it's like we do this online Zoom thing once a week and we have this group chat and we're constantly in conversation with like a small group of individuals all the time. And it's been such a benefit to us and to our souls. And just, and I'm very much a verbal processor. So I like kind of the small group dynamic anyways, because it allows me to process a lot of things that are going through and, you know, get feedback. And it's that whole iron sharpens iron thing. But I think that's the other view of it. So can you still have community? I think so, because I think we've been the benefits of growing in one of those communities. So,
Oh, that's really good. Pivoting a little bit, we I've chatted a number of times about youth ministry. You were a youth pastor for a long time here in DC. And one of the things you said that really stuck out to me, I have it written in a journal somewhere, and I was reminded of it as prepping for this, is you were talking to me about what it looks like to develop leaders. And you said this amazing statement. You said, you take things more seriously if you have a harder path to get there. And I love that. And it challenged me. And it's a little bit of what we're talking about. But would you mind just kind of expanding on that idea of you actually take something more seriously, something's more valuable to you, the harder it is to get to or to achieve or to get through?
Yeah. So the example of a youth pastor, the one that I always love to do was like your volunteer leaders. So like your youth leaders.
Yeah.
And so, okay, think about anything. Think about why do people want to go to Harvard? I think people want to go to Harvard, not because of necessarily the education, which is obviously going to be incredible. But I think people want to go to Harvard because it's hard to go to Harvard.
Right.
So when you know that you go to Harvard, you're a part of a group that made it. That was difficult. And so your commitment at that school is going to be very different because you were the ones that made it.
Right.
And so as a youth leader, we made it really hard for them to become a leader. Versus imagine, so for us, it was, you have to fill out a form. Then you have to sit down and have an interview. And then you have to sit there and answer like a bunch of questions about your life and really difficult things and have some things challenged or whatnot. And then you show up and then you're not even a leader. You're on probation. So you show up for like 2 months and then another leader basically vets you the whole time through. And then at the end of the 2 months, it's not even me. I go to the other leader and I say, are they fit to be here? And they can say yes or no. And so once you've kind of gone through that whole process of like this 3 month journey of almost, you know, having to try to be a part or 4 month or however long it takes, you finally get to the place where you're like, I appreciate now being on the other side of being a part of this and now belonging. Versus imagine it's like, hey, you want to be a youth leader? They're like, sure. Okay. Show up on Thursday. It's going to be sweet. Go to room, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then show up at 6 o'clock. Like they're probably their commitment, their care, their passion for that is going to be very, very different. And we all know just in practical life, the harder something is, the greater the payoff is when that thing's over. So it's the hike. Why are hikes so nice? It's a view. But why is that view so beautiful? Because I'm having an experience, depending on what the hike is. If you go on like a 20-mile journey in the, you know, backwater, whatever, and you get to this place that's stunning, a big piece of why you think that's so incredible is because not everybody has the same kind of journey that you had to get there to have that view or to take that picture or to see that thing or whatever. So that's a big piece of it. You think about the greatest kinds of food. The greatest kinds of food you eat is the ones that take time, right? So if it's a Christmas dinner where the meat or whatever has been marinating for like a couple days or something, or it's, you know, this thing has been sitting in a barrel or whatever for the last 20 years. You think of wine, it's like the older the wine is, the better the payoff. We have this example all around us and you find moments. So as an example for us, 2019, spring break, we took a group of 25 students to Guatemala. We have to get to the airport at 6 a.m. So we have to wait, you know, you got to wake up at like two basically to get there for, you know, 3:30. You sit there, you're with everybody. So it's like, so you're so tired. We get onto the airplane with these 25 students. And as soon as we get off the tarmac, the whole airplane like kind of halts, like right off, we get off the tarmac and we're like, oh my goodness, like what happened? And then the whole cabin begins to start to smell. And you're like, what is going on? So at this point, you know, me as a faithful leader that has to be really strong for my students, I fall asleep. So as I'm falling asleep, this thing's like 30 minutes in the air. We're like, circling, I wake up and I'm like, whoa, we're still in Vancouver and it's been like 30, 40 minutes. We get back down and they make us get off of the airplane. We have to go back through customs. It's like a whole thing. And then we get in a line for the airline. As we're in the line, one of the flight attendants of our flight walks past our big group of students who are just like all sitting on the floor watching Netflix, whatever. And he goes, "You want to see what happened?" And it was like, "Sure." And he shows a picture of 9 ducks that have flown into the turbines of the airplane and into the landing gear. And it was just like the most disgusting photo you've ever seen, but totally trashed the airplane.
Right.
And so that began a debacle for us that started like a 4-day journey of us going from Vancouver, taking a bus down to Seattle, going to Denver, going to Houston, finally ending up in Guatemala City, driving to the place. And what began to happen was, now that you look back, like however, like a year or whatever back, I'm like, that was one of the best trips ever because of the story behind it. Nobody wants to, right? You're in English 9 and your English teacher tells you the point of a story, when you write a story, is tension. If there's no tension in the story, it's not a good story. There is no story if there's no tension. And yet we're asking ourselves, I want so much ease. And yet when someone tells a crazy testimony in front of the church, we always look back at ourselves and we say, oh, why don't I have a story like that? Or so on and so forth. So it's kind of funny that the thing that we're actually longing for is the opposite of what we need. When that tension or the difficulty or how hard it took to get to that place or how long it took to get to that place or whatever, that payoff at the end of it, I think that's when you see leadership development. I think that journey, that difficulty. I'm the kind of person who doesn't give away too many compliments. When I say something, I want it to really mean something. And so you hear it with students all the time where we do a leadership program. It was a year long, every single Sunday. They would meet for like 2 hours at a time. So they had to be from grades 10 to 12. And it's an arduous process. We go through things like spiritual practices or theology. They would plan the events for our youth program, whatever. Then we get to the end of the year and we do this big Oregon surf trip with like 15 kids or something, right? Yeah. And one of the things that we did that was everybody's favorite moment was at the very end, I would basically sit everybody down in a big circle and then I would go one by one on every single student. And I would have a list of all of the things that I've noticed about them in the year and how they've grown and how they've whatever.
Yeah.
And I just let it all loose on them. And it was just like the biggest affirmation thing for 15 students from the whole year of not really hearing a whole lot.
Yeah.
And it's crazy how emotional they get. Because it's like, this actually means something. I can actually feel this. Like, this is tangible to me. And I think that's what difficulty in the process creates. It makes you feel it. Whereas something that, you know, you think about how quick something can come to you, you don't really treat it that well. You don't really care that much for it. So I think that's really the difference.
Do you think that plays into our own spiritual formation, whether or not we're developing as leaders? Does that play into just like our basic, like, baseline level of following of Jesus?
Yeah, I think so. I think every single crisis moment that Jesus went through was more about our view of him than rather his view of himself. And so if it wasn't for those crisis moments, how do we find any hope? If we don't see him, you know, bleeding blood in Gethsemane, it tells us something about solidarity. If we don't see him crucified on the cross, then how, there's a Japanese American theologian, I don't remember his name, but he basically said, the reason why it's so important to see all the sufferings of Christ is because we know that he has plumbed the bottom of human sadness and human misery. The incarnate Lord has plumbed human misery. He understands every single part of it. And so those crisis moments that he's experienced and what the benefit as human beings was from his suffering gives us a solidarity that when we get into those seasons, major growth can happen because we've already grown through his sufferings. And so on a personal basis, I feel like every single time you get into a situation, you either learn something about yourself, you grow and you step up, or you fail and you learn that you haven't learned that lesson yet. And all of those things are important.
That's good. How do we get okay with being there? Because I feel like everything on my Instagram feed and everything in our culture tells me like to avoid that at all costs. Like I do not want to be in a place where it's painful and it hurts. And like, you know, the image of Jesus, like sweating blood based on what he's facing in the garden, it is like this image that is so powerful in scripture. And yet it's so opposite of what our culture would tell me I'm supposed to pursue. Like I'm supposed to pursue like a comfortable bank account and a vacation to Cancun and to be able to like buy a coffee instead of have to make my own coffee. And like any of those things, how do we get, maybe comfortable is not the right word, but how do we get to a place where it's okay for us to lean into those things?
Yeah. It's probably a bigger rant, but I think biblical fluency or gospel fluency is probably mm-hmm. not things that we're very adept to. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, I would ask those exact same people, probably about their views about God. And how often their views about God aren't even their views about God, but it's secondhand thoughts of somebody else who has views mm-hmm. about God. Mm-hmm. And so that's really difficult. So as an example, if somebody asked me a scientific question, okay, say I was listening to a podcast like this and it was, and somebody made this like amazing science point. And then I go into a sermon and I say this amazing science point, right? And it's like, this is a true fact.
Yeah.
Someone comes up to me afterwards and goes, why is that true? And I go, I have no idea, but it is. That's a lot of people's Christian experience.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult because what you want to do is, I've heard the description of, you do not want to be a travel agent. You want to be a guide, which means where you are sending someone is a place that you have already been. So as a travel agent, you might send somebody to, you know, South America or something, but you might have never been there. And so you say, hey, here are a list of reviews. This is what Yelp says. This is blah, 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 blah. But you've never been there from firsthand experience. But you know that that place is great because everybody else is saying it. Versus imagine you're a guide. And you go to those ruins in that, you know, Central American country. And that guy's geeking out. He's like, oh, my goodness. Like, so we were in Guatemala and a guy took us on a volcano. And as we're on the volcano, you're walking on this path and there's cracks all through the ground. And he grabs a stick and he pulls out a marshmallow and he gives it to one of our kids. And the kids puts it into that gap. And it cooked the marshmallow. Like the magma underneath us was cooking the marshmallow.
Wow.
Yeah, and the guide was freaking out. And the kid was freaking out. And that was like a solid moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we have to have. I think our views of who Jesus is, as soon as we really get that under grips, then all of it changes. Because I look at the biblical story and I go, okay, comfort, health, wealth, prosperity, all of those things. God very clearly says to the Israelites, it's when you have all of those things that you forget who I am. So I look at the biblical story and I go, yeah, people who have it all and have all the comfort and don't have a need for the Lord, the biblical story is pretty much set up that that's actually a negative in terms of your affections, right? It's actually a negative in terms of your desire or really big, your dependency. I heard one person say that faith begins where your ability ends. And so if you have an overinflated view of your ability, then you're not going to really have an easy time with faith. Yeah. And so if everything can come easy to you, if everything can show up at your door, then faith isn't going to be as much of a necessity as you believe it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Oh man, we're running out of time, but this has been so good. One last question we just want to ask all our interviews is what's maybe one rhythm or practice that through a pandemic and through, I mean, for you especially, just so much change, so much transition, so much quietness in this season. What's a rhythm or a practice that you found especially helpful for following Jesus through this time?
Yeah, I would probably start off with like a word of caution. Because the idea of like rhythm, spiritual discipline, spiritual practices is like a really like it term right now.
Right.
And I think it's really helpful to redefine what those things are. So a spiritual practice, so my definition of a spiritual practice, really easy, are things that you do that make you love Jesus more. Okay? Things that you do that make you love Jesus more.
Yeah.
Which means that if you suck at silence and solitude, it's not that big of a deal because you doing it probably doesn't make you love Jesus more. Mm-hmm. So find the things that make you love Jesus more, and those things will be those spiritual practices that you need to participate in. Mm-hmm. So for me, I read the scriptures. When I read the scriptures, I am an ideas person. I'm a concepts person. I like find myself often driving in the car with no music and not realizing that that's been happening because I've just been in my head thinking about stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the Bible with all these ideas about God and all this theology and all this knowledge, that's like awesome for me.
Right.
And one of the things that I find most difficult, but the most beneficial is prayer. Something happens when I'm in prayer that is because I'm a pretty cognitive person. And so the experiential kind of mystical side of Christianity is always a little bit more difficult. But when I have entered into those spaces, I've found it really, really easy. I'm a person who hates creating structure. So I like walking into structure. So things like Lectio Divina or the Examen or things that have already been made through church history have been really good for me to have because it allows me to just break into something that I know, you know, thousands of years of the church have already participated in. So, for me, I don't think it's necessarily like a requirement via the Bible to practice Sabbath. I think it's just a good idea. So it's one of those things that I do, reading the scriptures, prayer. Those are the big ones. And then recently, this is going to be, I don't know if this is too much information or whatever, but I love like the shower or a bath. And I love them. I don't know what it is, but there's like a sensory thing. I think it's just like the water hitting you.
Sure.
And there's no noise other than you just hear that water. And the way that it makes me think and the way that it like grows my appreciation for stillness has a translation to the Lord that I think is just like amazing. So for me, it's like, oh man, I need to just sit there. I need to think. And I think trying to do as much as you possibly can. There's like that famous, I don't know, overused Willard quote or whatever, that the most basic thing that you should do is to keep God in the forefront of your mind at all times. Mm-hmm. And so that's regularly a practice for me. It's like when I'm doing everything, am I thinking about him first and foremost? I think that's a really important part of it. So think about how often you don't think about God when you're doing a godly thing and reverse that. And by that, I mean, how many times have I been in worship singing a song and never thought about Jesus once? I just know the song. So I sing it. And then I've been sitting there going like, no, like an intentional discipline of mine has to be that when I'm in these positions, he's at the forefront of my mind the whole time through. So that's been a big part for online church on Sunday mornings because you have so many distractions. You're making crepes, you know, in your pajamas as you're watching church or whatever. And it's like, no, like, make sure that you have him on your mind.
Yeah.
So
no, that's good. That's an awesome place to end. I cannot wait until Alberta opens because I feel like Calgary has a really good coffee scene. So I need to come and you need to show me all the best coffee shops in Calgary.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Yeah.
Awesome.
Lots of heavy hitters here.
Yes. Monogram is my like one that I know of for sure, but I'm sure there's many others I got to check out.
Yeah, cool. This is Monogram coffee right here.
I love it. Cool. Well, awesome. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us. And thanks for tuning in, everyone.